You know, I remember a story, Glenn, where one of our, you know, some employees left and came back, and I said, well, what was it like in the outside world? And they were working for a sales company. And he said, well, you know, Bill, there was something a little less fulfilling about selling to a muffler shop to run their business. And it did, it gave me a sense of pride and privilege to be able to work for a company doing good in the world for those things.
Hi, and welcome to the first episode of Data and Confused. In this episode, I'm going to be talking with Bill Walsh. Bill Walsh is a former employee of Blackbaud. He actually worked there for 30 years. And he's really, I would say, the premier expert on Blackbaud CRM, which is their premier fundraising system used by some of the largest nonprofits in the world, say the Fortune 500 of nonprofits, if you will. So enjoy this first episode of Data and Confused with Bill Walsh. Bill Walsh.
Hey, Glenn. Good to be here.
Welcome.
Thank you.
I appreciate you taking the time.
Couldn't be happier to join you, Glenn. I think this is a great opportunity for us just to have a conversation and just share some thoughts. And I'm grateful to have this chance to speak with you and share with everyone out there.
Yeah. Since our company works so closely with Blackbaud Software, I thought it would be just a wonderful opportunity to get a peek behind the scenes of somebody or with somebody who had worked at Blackbaud for 3 decades. Is that right?
It's scary to say out loud, but yes, I did pass the 30-year mark before my transition into other things, and really a long career there. Maybe longer than average in today's tech world.
Definitely longer than average in today's tech world. I can tell you, yeah. I mean, I talk to friends who are at Amazon, and you know, they kind of go through the Amazon, Microsoft, and Google here to a certain extent, trifecta, and it's in Meta. You know, it's rare to have somebody that will stay at a place like that 3 years even. That's more on the tech side though, where they're doing, you know, developments, a lot of coding and stuff like that. So
I hear you. I'm not, you know, one comment I'd make is, you know, my advice for others in their career is I was able to make transitions within my own company by changing jobs and department and keeping the energy and the excitement. So moving from products to sales to back to product management and then to customer success. So there's a constant reinvention of yourself, setting new goals and networking. That's really not much different than changing roles and simply going somewhere else. You know what I mean?
Sure. I guess, you know, is that something that you would say really came from you? Like you sought those things out, or is that part of the Blackbaud culture where that was something people could do?
A little of both. The drive has to be within the individual. There are people who stay in the same departments all their careers, and Blackbaud does tend to be a company that is somewhat of accepting of kind of building expertise and keeping it for a while. But it also did encourage or at least allow and support individuals to nurture their own careers. And most of the managers were and are, I believe, open to that kind of movement and growth within individuals.
Right. So when you first started at Blackbaud, like what was that like back then?
Oh my gosh, it was such a different company. And I don't know the exact number. I was somewhere between 60 and 70-ish employees when I started.
Wow, so really early on.
Early on, and privately held, privately managed, run by a British owner who had sort of that sense of a culture of loyalty, right? The longer you're there, the bigger your Christmas bonus. So a very different kind of approach than today's world for things.
And that planted the seed in your head. It's like, I'm going to get the biggest Christmas bonus ever, because I know if I just hold out long enough. Yeah.
Absolutely. I maxed out my vacation after 10 years, so you don't get any more vacation the longer you're there after 10.
Somebody pulled the rug out from under you. But when you first started there, like what, do you remember like the job interview?
Oh my gosh.
And what you were hired for? Do you remember? Interviewed you?
I don't tell that story very often, but I interviewed with customer support first to be a support analyst. Then I had just finished being a school teacher. And at that time, all of the customer support people also did training. And I said, you know, I've just been a school teacher. I don't really want to teach. And they asked me, you know, when they asked me if I wanted to teach. And so they said, okay, great. Thanks for coming by. And I never heard from them again. But I, there was another job for a quality assurance analyst. And I interviewed with Joe McNamara, who was there for a long time as well, and Richard Rogers. And I impressed them with my analytical skills, not necessarily my computer skills. The thing about that job, though, Glenn, is when you work in quality assurance, your job is to learn everything that you possibly can about how software works, why it works, does it do what it's supposed to be doing?
Sure.
You learn more than anyone around you if you're constantly asking those questions. And in essence, you're defining the software. So to some degree, my credibility and expertise of being the software expert came from that first career, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. So what was that software then that you were working on?
Oh man, I think one of my first projects was the Razor's Edge for DOS for the United Kingdom. And this was before the internet. So I picked up the phone and called the Inland Revenue Service in London from the phone offices in Blackbaud and said, I don't understand regulations on page 17, line 7 that require this gift aid distribution to be calculated. Can someone explain it to me? And they're like, excuse me, sir, I'll try to connect you. And so I was trying to help us define how gift aid and covenant based giving work. So those were it was odd and interesting things. I loved it, though. It was really fascinating.
So you had those kind of questions as part of the quality assurance process then. Gotcha. Checking the boxes for things, or is that something that came up from a customer?
That was part of our expansion into the UK market, was building out the form of tax-based rules that are, you know, in the United States, you have a gift and a receipt, and the donor receives the charitable portion as a deduction on their taxes. But in the UK, the charity can file to get the tax that was paid by the donor back as a way of getting an additional gift enhancement. And so my job was to understand how that worked and the calculations. And as I was saying, without the internet, imagine it's just a thick IRS regulation book, trying to decode it and figure those things out and go to the programmer and look and say, what is this screen doing and why is it doing that? So again, I guess I would say constantly asking questions was a bit of my mode of operation.
Yeah, yeah, sure, of course. So, I mean, were those same kind of complexities in the U.S., but you were in the U.S. already, or sort of had those?
Where I would say similar things, honestly, is like plan giving, right? So one of my projects was to build and develop our Paragon software. So I led the development for the tax calculation package back when Blackbaud offered us its own tools, similar to PG Calc, to say if a donor is going to give an intent of X $100,000 and it becomes a charitable remainder unit trust, a CRAT instrument. What's the tax calculation benefit in return to the donor? So it creates the illustrations for planned gift officers for all of those instruments. So yes, all of those complexities exist in the US, but in pockets of nuance related to the tax code. But it also taught me, Glenn, charitable intent is always there, and a lot of it can be about how do you appeal to the interest of a donor and yet manage the follow-ups, the communications, the stewardship? They all kind of relate, and what's the governmental impact of that? And software, I realized, became the vehicle and the engine to provide the efficiency and the mechanism to smooth those things over, but deliver to compliance and stewardship as well. So kind of circling it back to kind of how does that relate to nonprofits, it appealed to me. And I felt a little privileged working for a company that was serving social good with its software, as opposed to working on a banking system or some other type of technology.
Right.
And, you know, I remember a story, Glenn, where some employees left and came back, and I said, well, what was it like in the outside world? And they were working for a sales company. And he said, well, you know, Bill, there was something a little less fulfilling about selling to a muffler shop. To run their business, and it gave me a sense of pride and privilege to be able to work for a company doing good in the world for those things. How about you, Glenn? How did you get your start with technology and kind of work where nonprofits became an angle of focus for you? And did you feel a similar affinity as I've expressed?
Yeah, I mean, working with nonprofits now, we definitely You know, that's one of the many reasons that I shifted my focus once I had my own business, right, to focus on working with nonprofits as part of that. Just, yeah, feeling like what you're doing is making a difference in the world. But yeah, I had a roundabout way. So I got a degree in physics and had a background in science, and then ended up kind of pivoting into tech just when the internet was first starting. And so got a job at a startup in Seattle that was doing dial-up routers back when that was a thing.
So
I kind of cycled through some different internet startups, some worked for a bigger company called Emulex in there for a while too, and then eventually just decided to start on my own doing security consulting. Got back into hosting. I'd spent a lot of time with the startups, setting up hosting infrastructures, and just by chance started to host stuff for the Woodland Park Zoo here in Seattle.
Wonderful.
So they asked about, hey, we have this software that we don't know what quite to do with. It's kind of a hassle to manage for us. Can you host this for us? It's called the Razor's Edge. I'm like, yeah, I have no idea. Let me take a look. So we got in and figured out how to get that to work for them. So then they were happy. And then Seattle Aquarium came to us and said, hey, we hear you do this Blackbaud thing. We have that too. Can you help us? So, and then just little by little through word of mouth, we started to work with nonprofits. And I appreciated working with nonprofits partly because, they have budgets and they pay their bills, things that are not common necessarily amongst internet startups. They all think they're going to hockey stick up, and some of them do a different kind of hockey stick. And so,
Well, and they appreciate what you do for them too, right? Because that's a bit of a neat technology angle and some expertise that maybe they perhaps lack internally with terms of the security, the lockdown, their performance, all of the things that they're really searching for. They might struggle to hire the talent internally, not all of them for sure, of course, but some of them to be able to manage that for themselves.
Yeah. And I think it just goes to, just the software itself. And so I think because there is a lot of complexity in the Blackbaud software, right, where it's not just, like any other desktop application, like Word or whatever, just install it and it works. It's like, well, there's some stuff here. There's a few things you got to figure out and deal with. And there's a backend database and all of this, right? So yeah, it's not something that if you're you're the sysadmin, you're the IT guys, this is one application that you would like to probably get off your plate because it requires a level of expertise that, okay, do we want to invest our staff, the IT staff who have to maintain so many things, have to manage so many things, do they really want to have to also learn Razor's Edge or Blackbaud CRM or whatever? And sometimes they do, but sometimes, they want to try to get that stuff off their plate so they can just focus on the core things. So,
sure. And you're dealing with technology that really wasn't designed to be hosted in that way, right? I mean, client server implied that that's the case, but yet it's what we call fat client server, if you will, heavy traffic road to try to... Yep. Think about an internet pipe for the Razor's Edge 7 is quite a challenge you would take on technically, I imagine, to keep it running, keep it performing, balance the needs of the client side and the server side to give clients a great experience.
Yeah. So how do you think Blackbaud was able to just be so successful, I guess? I don't know. I mean, now there's maybe Salesforce is a competitor, although not really, but just like, how did they go from being Razor's Edge on DOS and just sort of this startup in some ways in the nonprofit technology field to being the main one, the 800-pound gorilla, how did they succeed?
I think personally that a lot of that was driven through the success and hard work of the teams in the 90s and two key transition points that took place then. That set the tone for the company throughout the 2000s, and that was first to market with a Windows-based product, and doing so with one that, although perhaps initially had a few bugs, let's say on its release, and with Windows with the 6 version, became dominant in the market with an ease of use and a look and feel that set itself apart from others. A solid sales team, a Y2K event that spurred the adoption of new software, and the ability of the company project itself as the tool that everyone wanted to have. So as fundraisers went from one organization to another, the dream would be to say, hey, I'm here. Are you using Raiser's Edge? If you're not, I'd like to bring it here. And so that mindset allowed the company to really create itself as the leader and the standard, sort of the aspirational tool. And I think today's market is very different. It's much more fragmented. There are many more players in the market. Others have caught up in terms of their abilities with gift processing and in other areas. And BlackBot suffered some reputational hits that I think have hurt it as well. But let's just say it's created a healthy market, so to speak, for everyone to compete. How's that, Glenn?
Sure. Yeah. So you would say they're like a pioneer at the time. Was there another competitor, or what did people do? Was it Excel spreadsheets and?
There were a couple of competitors. There was on the low end, something called Results Plus, which was sort of a cheap low end fundraising solution. There was Fundmaster, Appeal Master. Then back in the day, Millennium and Lucene Advance were two upper tier competitors, and especially in higher education. So there were quite a few around, but I think in the 90s, BlackBot dominated and acquired a few of the competition elements and expanded in the UK and abroad. And then we just saw difficulties for tools would disappear, like Results Plus. Lifestyle companies would come and go. I don't know, folks out there may know Viking, or there was PeopleSoft was a competitor at one point and was trying to make a go of it. So
on, that's interesting.
You had lifestyle companies and you had CRM companies, Oracle and PeopleSoft trying to come into the nonprofit space, but without investing the depth of talent and understanding.
Sure.
I remember a presentation once, Glenn, where I went into a room and it was me and two other people from BlackBot. And I was talking a lot about our products and solutions, and the Oracle said 10 people in the room and still they knew nothing about fundraising.
Yeah. Yeah.
That gives you kind of an illustration of what the world was like.
Yeah. Yeah. Reminds me of another company right now. It starts with the sales and ends with a force, but... but we digress. So, so your time at BlackBot, so like, what would you say you're most proud of for all of the different things you worked on?
I worked on a lot of products and really had a lot of different impact, in different areas, and not all of it, not everything went perfectly, just to be fair. So, I think a couple of things stand out at me. I contacted a former employee after I left the company and was just checking in with her to see how she was doing. And she said, I'm so glad you reached out. And I wanted to thank you for being a manager who listened to me and gave me opportunities to grow and advance in my career and live up to my potential. And not everyone has done that in the world. And so she just said, thank you. And I cried.
Sweet.
I really cried. So I guess... I know that that's not what I'm most proud of in terms of my customer side engagements, but in terms of, I did make mistakes, as a manager, but I did some good things too. And that made me feel good.
That's the teacher in you.
Yeah, that's the teacher in you coming out.
There's a mentor in there
that just came out
regardless of you saying, I don't want to teach anymore.
The other thing I think is helping BlackBot CRM live up to its full potential. I had a lot of work with the Raiser's Edge, but I eventually became really the face of BlackBot CRM for the company. Initially it needed some help and some growth to live up to the promise that I was making and the company was making about what it could do to live up to some of the platform capabilities, but really sticking it out to work closely with the products team and eventually work with the products team and turn it into something to be proud of. And it took a lot of work and a lot of team members and a lot of hard, smart people stepping up to make that happen. But I was pleased to be some part of that so that it could be a great solution in market, if that makes sense, Ben.
Yeah, so what does CRM do that Raiser's Edge didn't? And why would an organization say, hey, I need a CRM, whereas Raiser's Edge was holding me back for performance or technical or whatever reasons? Like, why have Blackbaud CRM?
I can answer that in a couple of different ways. I spent a lot of my life answering that question.
Yeah. It's a softball. Sorry, no, I didn't mean to give you a softball. Okay.
Let's start with one analogy that I'll say. People think of the Raiser's Edge as their donor relations tool, and sure, the people that go into it are donors, right? And okay, I run into a lot of people who would say that record can't be in there because they haven't given us a gift, or they don't have the potential to give us a gift. So it's highly associated with a donor initially. And so the renaming of a Blackbaud CRM was primarily designed to break down those walls and barriers of resistance that people had for still relationship-based fundraising primarily, volunteers, attorneys, children, organizations, corporations, foundations, growing the depth and spectrum of individuals and the depth and spectrum of corporations, and then allowing to see the interweaving relationships between all of them. That was one key thing, and the security to go along with that. I remember talking to a Raiser's Edge prospect once, and they said, well, we have a volunteer team and we want to put some volunteers in, but we need to isolate and partition those portion of records and the data that people can see when they log in. Show me how you do that. And you can't. You can't.
Right.
You can't carve out records and information and precisely enough in Raiser's Edge for that use case. Does that make sense?
Yeah. That makes total sense.
That's one. And the other big thing is really just growth and comprehensiveness of how an organization does fundraising. What scale has it grown to? Is it nationwide with tens of millions of dollars of fundraising through a wide variety of sources?
Right.
Those are the short answer. Otherwise, I'd talk all day about that one, Glenn.
So PeopleSoft wasn't wrong. You needed that same CRM-ish data concepts coming in, but needed to do it in a way that made sense.
I love that you said that. I remember working with sort of the contributor relations team and finding out a little bit more about them. It was a team of two. So, you know, I think they only had two product managers and a small team of programmers, and they're trying to build out this fundraising system on top. And I guess what I would say is it takes millions of dollars to build fundraising systems on top of CRM. And it's not a quick, you know, flick of a switch or a few developers and you're going to come at it. So
when you have CRM at an organization, say, you know, because we work with different kinds of organizations, right? There's healthcare, there's higher ed, there's, you know, cause-based, faith-based, that sort of thing. Like, I look at nonprofits, I'm just like, they're pretty much the same, you know, 80% the same, maybe 20% different per organization. But what does that really look like? Like, how different are these guys in terms of the modules that they use or how their data, the data that they're doing, using, all that sort of stuff? Is it 80-20 or is it 20-80?
No, I'd actually get closer to much more variance and divergence. Having been on the sales side, you know, working with Raiser's Edge and going into organizations of different types and sizes, one of the things that I would do is look up at their 990 form, and I would go to say, where does their revenue stream come from? And you think about organizations that hold a lot of events, organizations that have a membership component, organizations that do an annual fund drive, organizations that do a capital campaign, organizations that do peer-to-peer fundraising, organizations that have a heavy tribute component, organizations that come at it from recurring gifts, organizations that are funded heavily by planned giving. Each of those is a different slice of income pie, and each of them requires a different type of staff internally to think about the nurturing and the growth and the management of those revenue streams. And I say that thing about membership, right? You probably work with a few that do and some that don't. And so that means you have to have a services team thinking about it, a team thinking about your membership programs and your your levels and your tiers, your retention right. programs and efforts. And those are very different maybe than some other type. And so the number of ways that you raise money and the scale at which each of those operates changes. Do I need a module or do I not? And if I do need a module, does it need to be the best in the world or does it just need to be good enough? And Salesforce really made inroads primarily because they came at it with a good enough product. It wasn't as good as Razor's Edge. It probably still isn't. But did it hit a good enough level on some features and capabilities to become competitive, where somebody that didn't need, maybe they don't process 5,000 tributes per month, they get 100 tributes per month. So the fact that these are sort of custom fields and attributes on a few screens, nobody really cares that it doesn't work great. It just needs to have some data. So that one little thing I just mentioned is representative of, if you look across the spectrum of fundraising, of what do you really need? How big, deep, and wide is that portion of your organization? And do you do all of it? In which case, that's where we started to see that sort of enterprise nature of Blackbaud CRM become a strength, which is no matter how big any one programmatic area is, it can scale in Blackbaud CRM. You'll never hit a boundary of that's too many records for it to handle here, or too high a volume. There's always a process for it. In Razor's Edge, you will hit some boundaries if your programs get to certain sizes. Hope that helps a little bit, right?
Yeah, I mean, so I'm just imagining if I'm a manager, if I'm, you know, advancement VP, or, you know, I'm in a position at an organization of that caliber to be making these decisions. Sort of, how do you make that decision, and sort of what are the skills, maybe even like the underrated skills that a person like that needs in that position to be able to evaluate these different technologies and to make the right decision.
One thing to keep in mind is they don't go through this process all that often. So it's not a muscle tone that anyone develops. I've been, you know, there were always search firms in the business, and back in the day there were, just a whole bunch of people. I just remember Jim Williamson, and there's a whole list of people that they would call, and we would go through these system evaluations.
So a search firm, what do you mean by a search firm?
A selection firm, sorry. So
so this would be like a consulting firm that helps the organization do this evaluation. Okay.
Do a selection, and they can be scaled in size and cost to help suit the needs. But they provide a process, an evaluation, a template, requirements from other organizations that can add a price, and not everybody wants to do it, but it can at least help create some apples to apples and also force a fair comparison to the board so that it doesn't become a preferential game of politics of who's the favorite system of some particular influencer in the process. That's one thing that I would suggest. The other thing, I think people try to throw sort of everything at the selection and say it needs to be great at volunteer, and it needs to be great at fundraising, and it needs to be great at events and then check-ins. And sometimes you do want one system to do it all, but I think you again need to come back to say, where does most of our money come from, and what needs to be first class and the best in the world? And let's make sure we've put a little bit of focus and emphasis on that particular area. If you raise a lot through major gifts or through your annual fund or through planned giving or through team raising events, you can't let that suffer, or you'll see a decrease or a decline in giving. So let's make sure you hit the high points first and then create sort of a longer tail of priorities and requirements. It doesn't mean don't go after it all. It just means be selective and thoughtful about it, because when your spreadsheet starts to get 5,000 line items, I mean, come on, it's like, really, you want one system that's just going to do all of those things?
So for nonprofits and foundations, you know, you're talking about them focusing on, you know, where the money's coming from. Is it just a matter of efficiency? So in other words, I get the software now, I will know now we can get 20% more, 30% more, 50%, 100% more, because now basically we have the right tool to be able to do that. Is it just kind of just a numbers game that way?
Yeah. I don't believe that, no. You know, even organizations today, I would come in the door often, you know, during the sales cycle and just take a look at what you're doing and how things are going. And there might be a few times when it's like, you know, you maybe should just stay where you are. But there were a lot of outdated systems out there, and particularly if you're thinking about trying to transition from, say, an AS400 and it's being de-supported, or the support staff costs are so high for that and the hardware, it might make sense. If they're using a green screen system with limited fields and information, you've got to come to the Razor's Edge or Blackbaud CRM, and I could easily demonstrate improvements or requirements. But I think so many organizations have reached a place where what they have today is probably working pretty well for them. I would actually challenge it a little bit to say, take a look at your leadership and your goal setting and your objectives and how you are approaching the processes of achieving those goals. And it may be that you could take the system you have today and put those improvements in place. It might be overlaying a system that doesn't have modern analytics and reporting with a Power BI solution and a Microsoft Fabric framework to do AI and putting in some workflows. Hopefully the solution would support some level of automation and interaction. You might not have to replace the system to achieve those goals. And I say that, Glenn, because setting the goals and driving clear leadership in order to work towards those specific outcomes, specific directives from leadership to how you want to raise more money and be more effective, I've seen be the most effective tool to raise more money than changing the system itself.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
Sorry to say it that way, but that.
Yeah. That makes sense. It makes total sense. And I guess in that regard, like, are there some industry-wide trends or even just, you know, societal cultural trends? Now, I was at a conference a few years ago and someone was talking about how, you know, the recurring giving, we'll call it, donors that are giving smaller amounts, say $50, $100, $200, whatever, a year toward the various causes, those were becoming less and less. And so, and it was really the major gifts that were becoming a bigger piece of the pie. And there was this trend, this overall trend toward focusing more on major gifts and focusing more on trying to find those donors. Is that true? Is that a trend that you, or does it really depend on the organization?
I think it depends on the organization. Not everyone is capable of becoming a major gift-centric organization. It doesn't always work. Takes an investment in time and energy and resources, and having an affinity or an ability to appeal either at the local level or regional level or national level to the right kind of donors. And so not everyone can do that. And so I'd be a little cautious in just making big wide shifts like that without thinking it through and having the right buy-in from leadership and the board. Those are things that make a big difference. I do see trends towards larger gifts from fewer major donors, right? So, and increasing sizes of average gifts, but potentially fewer donors in a donor pool. And so that those trends are starting to sort of emerge for some. So then retention sure. becomes really critical. What's your donor stewardship program? What's your process to nurture and encourage? And how are you moving people from mid-tier into higher tier bands? And I know right. That's maybe speaking out of both sides of my mouth, but those are all things that you can do even if you're struggling for a major gift, right? And Glenn, keep in mind, I've been across the spectrum, right? So a big yeah. gift is $1,000.
Sure.
$2,500.
Yeah, it's all relative.
$1,000.
Yeah,
or makes. One place, nothing's a big gift until it hits $5 million. And so
okay.
this spread of what you consider a major gift can have a big impact on this conversation that we're having.
And how much of that is a human-to-human connection? In other words, there's a person at the organization that's, you know, talking with these donors, that is making them feel like what they're doing matters, that how much of that is a really a personal connection versus getting, you know, emails and updates and other kinds of, I don't know, sort of not human.
I think closing the gift is always human.
Yeah.
And that's the riskiest stage, but the buildup with the goodwill and the passion, that those are lifelong, right? Or those are ongoing. So that journey takes time. And so I would say that all of those earlier phases, you know, they've done look at all the studies. It's like if you can just do some phone bank calling and reach out to your donors and do some personal thank yous and fit it into your time band, then it pays off down the road when they want to make a bigger gift later. So I'm sort of saying two things. The relationship matters up to the point of that capability. And then when someone does develop that intent, they have to have the ability to smooth that through and not run into bumps and hiccups that would stop it. And I'm sure a major gift officer would have a different answer for you in terms of how much their skill and ability matters. And I'm no way trivializing that. I'm not at all. The 2-year cycle, that can make a huge difference. But the donor intent has to be there. The passion has to be there. There has to be some connection to the institution. And that can't have been eroded through some misstep, if that makes sense. That would create the friction.
Yeah, I guess I'm just wondering in this era of AI, big data, that sort of thing, where you have data scientists, you have prospect researchers, you have, you know, sort of a data mind where you're saying, okay, we're going to apply some of these new concepts, bring possibly AI in, and it can play out these different kind of scenarios and maybe say, okay, these ones are going to be the most likely for you to go after. Okay, humans, now go ahead and close the deal and go after these people. Like, what role do you see, you know, these new technologies like AI playing in helping organizations, you know, increase donations?
No, I'm glad you brought that up. I think that was a good lead in. And I think it kind of fits my philosophy, which is really a human-centric approach to fundraising and a human-centric approach to AI enhancement and augmentation of fundraising. And so I think there may be some places where AI replaces human in the loop for mass communications and automation. But in my personal beliefs, we should be focused more on where are scenarios when AI provides a lift to a human to allow them to expand their reach larger than it would have been without it, increase their capacity to handle workloads, increase their effectiveness, their rate of closure. And those are, surfacing of better information and prospects. So things that I'm exploring right now and projects that I'm engaged with are places where we could take, let's say, for example, a researcher role, and a researcher serves a certain number of fundraisers, but they only have a limited number of researchers at an institution that can be effective. And there are certain schools maybe in a university that are underserved because they don't have their staff or the resources to handle it. How could AI augment and supplement a researcher to do more with the data in the system and allow them to be more effective in that? Same thing for fundraising as well. How could we find better prospects, take the prospects that are there and create and persist better information through machine learning? So I'd love to focus there. It doesn't mean, by the way, Glenn, that people won't be attacking AI from, you don't need fundraisers or you don't need this or that. I'm not convinced that, to me, that's the best approach. Right. I think we can help people do better and do more with the information, because I think the information in the system is probably under leveraged and underutilized as it is. Nonprofits have more data than they know what to do with.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Right. It's like, I can't tell you the number of times I'm talking to a data administrator and it's like, well, they want me to enter all these codes on the gift and do all this and that. And I don't even know if they're using the channel and the inbound. Yeah. And, you know, are they doing it? I'm like, they may not be, that they could. That's so, you think about that, right? How would AI and visualization tools provide better decision-making ability for the institution and let them operate smarter?
Yeah.
So that's how I think about the dream for AI impacting nonprofits.
Yeah. I wonder if it could really help sort of dig through some of the historical, you don't have to necessarily go back that far, but I had dabbled for a while in doing data visualization and data analytics using Tableau with organizations. And I had in my mind this concept of like, okay, if they're using Razor's Edge or Blackbaud CRM, like their data is going to be 80% the same because the scheme is the same. And so we'll be able to build up some basic stuff and then tweak it, you know, as needed per organization. But it didn't turn out to be that way because organizations, I couldn't believe how vastly different they were and even vastly different over time. So we'd be looking at their data and it was almost like going through the fossil record where it's like, okay, during this era, when this person was in charge of how things were coded, it was coded in this way. And then this, you know, then the person before them coded it in this other way. And they also include these other things. And it, you just go back through time. You're just like, why? So, you almost need like a mapping that's just like, okay, you know, back in the Mesozoic era, we had this kind of data. Then during the Jurassic era, we had this kind of data and you kind of work your way up. And so maybe AI could help with something like that.
What do you think about that?
I don't know, but I think, I see, you know, this isn't a dig, but I see nonprofits as being more of a technology laggard typically, right? So they're not typically on the cutting edge of things. Maybe they are on certain kinds of things, like around, you know, outreach or marketing or something like that, that might be more, you know, experimental and want to try different things with depending on the organization. But I think as a whole, they tend to be more conservative and they like to see what everyone else is doing first. And then if it's, you know, enough people kind of have a consensus around it, it's like, okay, it's safe to do that. We'll go ahead and do that thing. So I see AI as being one of those things now that when I'm talking to people, I see there's a lot of reticence and just general nervousness, I guess, around AI. Has that been your experience or what is your take?
I agree. The conversations I have, people feel a little bit like they might be behind. And so there's a little bit of fear that someone else is getting ahead and using AI more effectively than they are. And therefore is, I don't know, winning the race is the wrong term, but somebody else is getting ahead and that might create a challenge. And I think it even comes from the board and, you know, the board asking what are our AI initiatives.
Sure.
I did have a great conversation with somebody about that. And it was, well, what is our AI policy and how are we thinking about that? So they might jump headfirst into AI, but be doing something that they don't believe in. So it takes a little bit of work. I am seeing, Glenn, though, just first, I don't think anybody's way ahead of the game right now in terms of specific nonprofits. I don't think that there's been these magical stories emerging that someone has run machine learning against their database and produced incredible results, or we would have seen it. And if it's happening, I think it's happening in private with maybe some of the really big, largest ones, but I don't think it's trickling out. So I see demand, I see interest, and I see exploration. One of the things that I'm doing with a few folks is just having the conversation. What if we had some trials? What if we did a few tests? Could we create a hypothesis about something that AI might produce and then keep the cost down and try to produce results? And so, I don't know, let's say you spent $20,000 and you got one major gift for $50,000 back. Is that a win or a loss? And can we create opportunities for bigger pots to come out? But I'm trying to help temper expectations with the way I'm saying that as well, right? In that it may not be a multi-million dollar play that's going to happen tomorrow. I think you think about the billion-dollar AI industry and how much money is being poured into it. It's creating these sort of investor-level expectations of returns. Are you seeing that as well, kind of? Are this sort of outsized expectations?
I don't know about outsized expectations, but I think I see it as really falling more on the prospect researcher's lap, because that's traditionally where I've seen, at least, those are the folks that are doing data science, doing machine learning. You know, there's a prospect research conference a few years ago that we were at, I think even before COVID, and they were talking about R and, you know, machine learning things. And, you know, at the time everyone was just like, wow, this is so, you know, this is so out there, but I saw it as being limited to those folks. I guess if you're a nonprofit now, like, what should you be wary of? Because, you know, you don't want your data to be misused or mishandled, or you still have concerns about the sensitive data that you have. how can an organization dabble in AI, play around with these kinds of things, but do it in a safe way?
You know, I think one thing people maybe aren't paying attention to, so I would just probably call it out, are using free tools like ChatGPT and the free version and forgetting to go turn off settings like exclude this data from the training database. So, I mean, just right off the bat, when I went to start, you know, producing certain documents and allowing AI to help me in my conversations with nonprofits and producing templates and documents and meeting reports and standards. And it was a lot of work I was doing around sort of nonprofit specific templates. And the first thing I realized is people are probably thinking about a gift agreement or a donor agreement or a statement, and they may be uploading it and asking for help and not excluding that from privacy controls. So I think one thing I would say is come up with a standard for the organization, whether it's ChatGPT Pro or one of the other tools or Microsoft, but enforcing organizational standards for privacy within the documents that get uploaded. Probably basic. So sorry, Glenn. And that may be like level one, and we're supposed to be up here, but I just worry that people aren't thinking about that kind of thing, you know?
No, I don't think that is at all. I think having policies like that, or just letting people know it's okay. We want you to use these tools. Here's use cases for them.
Yes.
Please let's go ahead and make sure that you're turning this on. This is why we're turning it on. But after that, please go ahead and let us know and share with each other what you're finding, and at least get people just getting comfortable, I think. That's what I think.
I love what you're saying. I had a group session the other day with some other consultants, and we said, we're each going to go away and use a different tool. We're going to test Gemini. We're going to test ChatGPT. We're going to use Claude. We're going to do some other ones. We're going to have Microsoft.
Sure.
We're going to compare notes, and we're going to talk through what we learned and how we approached prompts and how we approached what I'd call, you know, continuing the use of prompts and not giving up on the first one. So this was at the level of personal productivity.
Right.
And I do think organizations could benefit from that. Those that are perhaps just saying no to everything, that would be one thing. That was a little bit of a sidebar, if you will, from how do we take our data and enhance it. So I apologize if I kind of took us down a rabbit hole.
No, it makes sense. I mean, it's all connected. And I guess, you know, just to kind of wrap things up here, I would say, what's, you know, is there a best practice, if you will, that an organization can adopt when it just comes to these new technologies and technology in general when in relation to their data?
Let me throw this out there and just see. It might be controversial, and not everyone can afford this answer. So it's a little bit of a privilege to be able to do this, but every organization has people who care about new technologies and, you know, people who get excited about it. You know, Glenn, I'm the kind of person, it's like, I want the new toy. I'll play with it. I'll come back. I'll tell you what's great about it. And I don't care if it breaks. It's okay with me that it breaks. I expect it to. I love dealing with that. So who are those champions?
That's that quality assurance guy coming out again. Yes.
But imagine if they could just give a little bit of time and the like tools like Microsoft Copilot Studio or have free trials. Fabric has a free trial.
Yeah.
Give themselves some room to breathe and learn safely, create a safe space and an environment to allow for experimentation with some barriers and guidelines and firewalls around data security and privacy.
Yeah.
But would I be afraid? Yeah, sandbox. I'd be afraid that some company would come in and say, hey, look what we can do for you. And they don't know enough because they don't have anybody inside their house who can have the one-on-one conversation. Well, how is your machine learning algorithm working? What are your processes like? And what are your privacy? And how is our data shared with others? And all the things, just thinking all that through, that's just one thought, you know, just creating a little room with the people who want to do it anyway and are probably at home installing an LLM on their local desktop and running it on their graphics card, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's controversial to say that, but I think just in general, I like that approach. It makes sense to say a lot of times they'll want to just jump to the final answer. It's just like, okay, here's AI. How's it going to make me $5 million extra in donations this quarter, this month, whatever, versus why don't we play with it first? What's a safe way that we can play with it and see what some things are that it can do, that it can't do, maybe some things that we hadn't thought about that might come out of just playing with it, but just have this ability to test things out first before you try to immediately put it into production and try to make it part of your core.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I love it, Glenn. I hope we could continue some conversations and find some
absolutely
to talk about as well. I've enjoyed this opportunity to share and
I appreciate you sharing
a little more about you as well. So hopefully we can keep it going.
For sure. All right. Thank you so much, Bill. It was wonderful talking with you.
Take care.
All right. All right. Thank you so much for tuning in to Data and Confused. I really appreciate you listening. Please go ahead and subscribe as I get this podcast off the ground. I have a lot of amazing guests planned, industry experts and thought leaders from the tech and cybersecurity world. So look forward to seeing you in future episodes. Thank you.